Breathing bodies of the condemned, who screamed in supplication. I was speechless looking at these two monstrous giants. I could not count the number of wriggling human bodies they held, victims stuffed into the hollow framework of their enormous legs, their torsos, their arms, even their hands, and even into their immense and faceless cage-like heads, which were crowned with ivy leaves and flowers. Ropes of flowers made up the woman's gown, and stalks of wheat were stuffed into the man's great belt of ivy. The figures shivered as if they might at any moment fall, but I knew the powerful cross-scaffolding of timbers supported them as they appeared to tower over the distant forest, and all around the feet of these figures were stacked the bundles of kindling and pitch-soaked wood that would soon ignite them. "And all these who must die are guilty of some wrongdoing? You wish me to believe that?" I asked of Mael. He nodded with his usual solemnity. This didn't concern him. "They have waited months, some years, to be sacrificed," he said, almost indifferently. "They come from all over the land, and they cannot change their fate any more than we can change ours. It is to perish in the forms of the great mother and her lover." I was becoming ever more desperate. I should have done anything to escape. But even now some 20 druids surrounded the cart, and beyond them was a legion of warriors, and the crowd itself went so far back into the trees that I could see no end to it. Darkness was falling quickly, and everywhere torches were being lighted. I could feel the roar of excited voices. The screams of the condemned grew ever more piercing and beseeching. I sat still and tried to deliver my mind from panic. If I could not escape, then I would meet these strange ceremonies with some degree of calm. And when it came clear what a sham they were, I would with dignity and righteousness pronounce my judgments loud enough for others to hear them. That would be my last act, the act of the god. And it must be done with authority, or else it would do nothing in the scheme of things. The cart began to move. There was much noise, shouting, and Mael rose and took my arm and steadied me. When the flap was opened, we had come to a stop deep in the woods many yards from the clearing. I glanced back at the lurid sight of the immense figures, torch light glinting on the swarm of pathetic movement inside them. They seemed animate, these horrors, like things that would suddenly start to walk and crush all of us. The play of light and shadow on those stuffed into the giant heads gave a false impression of hideous faces. I couldn't make myself turn away from it, and from the sight of the crowd gathered all around, but Mael tightened his grip on my arm and said that I must come now to the sanctuary of the god with the elect of the priesthood. The others closed me in, obviously trying to conceal me. I realized the crowd did not know what was happening now. In all likelihood they knew only that the sacrifices would soon begin, and some manifestation of the god would be claimed by the druids. Only one of the band carried a torch, and he led the way deeper into the evening darkness, Mael at my side and other white-robed figures ahead of me, flanking me and behind me. It was still. It was damp, and the trees rose to such dizzying heights against the vanishing glow of the distant sky that they seemed to be growing even as I looked up at them. I could run now, I thought. But how far would I get before this entire race of people came thundering after me? But we had come into a grove, and I saw in the feeble light of the flames dreadful faces carved into the barks of the trees and human skulls on stakes grinning in the shadows. In carved-out tree trunks were other skulls in rows, piled one row upon another. In fact, the place was a regular charnel house, and the silence that enclosed us seemed to give life to these horrid things, to let them speak suddenly. I tried to shake the illusion, the sense that these staring skulls were watching. There is no one really watching, I thought. There is no continuous awareness of anything. But we had paused before a gnarled oak of such enormous girth that I doubted my senses. How old it must have been, this tree, to have grown to such width I couldn't imagine. But when I looked up, I saw that its soaring limbs were still alive, It was still in green leaf, and the living mistletoe everywhere decorated it. The druids had stepped away to right and left. Only Mael remained near me, and I stood facing the oak, with Mael at my far right, and I saw that hundreds of bouquets of flowers had been laid at the base of the tree, their little blooms barely showing any colour anymore in the gathering shadows. Mael had bowed his head, his eyes were closed, and it seemed the others were in the same attitude, and their bodies were trembling. I felt the cool breeze stir the green grass. I heard the leaves all around us carry the breeze in a loud and long sigh that died away as it had come in the forest. And then very distinctly I heard words spoken in the dark that had no sound to them. They came undeniably from within the tree itself, and they asked whether or not all the conditions had been met by him who would drink the divine blood tonight. For a moment I thought that I was going mad. They had drugged me. But I had drunk nothing since morning. My head was clear, too painfully clear, and I heard the silent pulse of this personage again, and it was asking questions. "He is a man of learning?" Mael's slender form seemed to shimmer as surely he expressed the answer, and the faces of the others had become rapt, their eyes fixed on the great oak, a flutter of the torch, the only movement. "Can he go down into Egypt?" I saw Mael nod, and the tears rose in his eyes, and his pale throat moved as he swallowed. "Yes, I live, my faithful one, and I speak, and you have done well, and I shall make the new god. Send him in to me." I was too astonished to speak, and I had nothing to say either. Everything had changed. Everything that I believed, depended upon, had suddenly been called into question. I hadn't the slightest fear, only paralyzing amazement. Mael took me by the arm. The other druids came to assist him, and I was led around the oak, clear of the flowers heaped at its roots, until we stood behind it, before a huge pile of stones banked against it. The grove had its carved images on this side as well, its troves of skulls, and the pale figures of druids whom I had not seen before. And it was these men, some with long white beards, who drifted forward to lay their hands on the stones and start to remove them. Mael and the others worked with them, silently lifting these great rocks and casting them aside, some of the stones so heavy that three men had to lift them. And finally there was revealed, in the base of the oak, a heavy doorway of iron, with huge locks over it. Mael drew out an iron key, and he said some long words in the language of the Keltoi, to which the others gave responses. Mael's hand was shaking, but he soon had all the locks undone, and then it took four of the druids to pull back the door, and then the torch-bearer lighted another brand for me and placed it in my hands, and Mael said, "Enter, Marius." In the wavering light we glanced at each other. He seemed a helpless creature, unable to move his limbs, though his heart brimmed as he looked at me. I knew now the barest glimpse of the wonder that had shaped him and inflamed him, and was utterly humbled and baffled by its origins. But from within the tree, from the darkness beyond this rudely cut doorway, there came the silent one again. "Do not be afraid, Marius. I wait for you. Take the light and come to me."
7. When I stepped through the doorway, the druids closed it, and I realized that I stood at the top of a long stone stairs. It was a configuration I was to see over and over again in the centuries that followed. And you have already seen it twice, and you will see it again. The steps leading down into the Mother Earth, into the chambers where those who drink the blood always hide. The oak itself contained a chamber, low and unfinished, the light of my torch glinting on the rude marks left everywhere in the wood by the chisels, but the thing that called me was at the bottom of the stairs, and again it told me that I must not be afraid. I was not afraid. I was exhilarated beyond my wildest dreams, I was not going to die as simply as I had imagined. I was descending to a mystery that was infinitely more interesting than I had ever thought it would be. But when I reached the bottom of the narrow steps and stood in the small stone chamber there, I was terrified by what I saw, terrified and repelled by it, the loathing and fear so immediate that I felt a lump rising to suffocate me or make me uncontrollably sick. A creature sat on a stone bench opposite the foot of the stairway, and in the full light of the torch I saw that it had the face and limbs of a man. But it was burnt black all over, horribly burnt, its skin shriveled to its very bones. In fact, it appeared a yellow-eyed skeleton coated in pitch, only its flowing mane of white hair untouched. It opened its mouth to speak, and I saw its white teeth, its fang teeth, and I gripped the torch firmly, trying not to scream like a fool. "Do not come too close to me," it said. "Stand there where I may really see you, not as they see you, but as my eyes can still see." I swallowed, tried to breathe easily. No human being could have been burnt like that and survived. And yet the thing lived, naked and shrunken and black, and its voice was low and beautiful. It rose and then moved slowly across the chamber. It pointed its finger at me, and the yellow eyes widened slightly, revealing a blood-red tinge in the light. "What do you want of me?" I whispered before I could stop myself. "Why have I been brought here?" "Calamity," he said in the same voice, colored with genuine feeling, not the rasping sound I had expected from such a thing. "I will give you my power. Marius, I will make you a god, and you will be immortal. But you must leave here when it is finished. You must somehow escape our faithful worshippers, and you must go down into Egypt to find why this has befallen me." He appeared to be floating in the darkness, his hair a mop of white straw around him, his jaws stretching the blackened, leathery skin that clung to his skull as he spoke. "You see, we are the enemies of light, we gods of darkness. We serve the Holy Mother, and we live and rule only by the light of the moon. But our enemy, the sun, has escaped his natural path, and sought us out in darkness. All over the north country where we worshipped, in the sacred groves from the lands of snow and ice, down into this fruitful country, and to the east, the sun has found its way into the sanctuary by day, or the world by night, and burned the gods alive. The youngest of these perished utterly, some exploding like comets before their worshippers. Others died in such heat that the sacred tree itself became a funeral pyre. Only the old ones, the ones who have long served the Great Mother, continued to walk and to talk as I do, but in agony, affrighting the faithful worshippers when they appeared. There must be a new god, Marius, strong and beautiful as I was, the lover of the Great Mother, but more truly there must be one strong enough to escape the worshippers, to get out of the oak somehow, and to go down into Egypt and seek out the old gods, and find why this calamity has occurred. You must go to Egypt, Marius. You must go into Alexandria and into the older cities, and you must summon the gods with a silent voice that you will have after I make you, and you must find who lives still and who walks still, and why this calamity has occurred. It closed its eyes now. It stood still, its light frame wavering uncontrollably as if it were a thing made of black paper. And I saw suddenly, unaccountably, a spill of violent images, these gods of the grove bursting into flame. I heard their screams. My mind, being rational, being Roman, resisted these images. It tried to memorize and contain them rather than yield to them, but the maker of the images, this thing, was patient, and the images went on. I saw the country that could only be Egypt, the burnt yellow look to all things, the sand that overlies everything and soils it and dusts it to the same colour. And I saw more stairways into the earth, and I saw sanctuaries. "Find them," he said. "Find why and how this has come to pass. See to it that it never comes to pass again. Use your powers in the streets of Alexandria until you find the old ones. Pray the old ones are there, as I am still here." I was too shocked to answer, too humbled by the mystery. And perhaps there was even a moment when I accepted this destiny, accepted it completely, but I am not sure. "I know," he said, "from me you can keep no secrets. You do not wish to be the god of the grove, and you will seek to escape. But you see, this disaster may seek you out wherever you are, unless you discover the cause and the prevention of it. So I know you will go into Egypt, else you too, in the womb of the night or the womb of the dark earth, may be burnt by this unnatural sun." It came towards me a little, dragging its dried feet on the stone floor. "Now mark my words, you must escape this very night," it said. "I will tell the worshippers that you must go down into Egypt for the salvation of all of us, but having a new and able god they will be loath to part with him. You must go down, and you must not let them imprison you in the oak after the festival. You must travel fast, and before sunrise go into the Mother Earth to escape the light. She will protect you. Now come to me. I will give you the blood. And pray I still have the power to give you my ancient strength. It will be slow. It will be long. I will take and I will give, and I will take and I will give, but I must do it. And you must become the god, and you must do as I have said." Without waiting for my compliance, it was suddenly on me, its blackened fingers clutching at me, the torch falling from my hands. I fell backwards on the stairs, but its teeth were already in my throat. You know what happened. You know what it was to feel the blood being drawn, to feel the swoon. I saw in those moments the tombs and temples of Egypt. I saw two figures, resplendent as they sat side by side as if on a throne. I saw and heard other voices speaking to me in other languages. And underneath it all there came the same command. Serve the mother. Take the blood of the sacrifice. Preside over the worship that is the only worship, the eternal worship of the grove. I was struggling as one struggles in dreams, unable to cry out, unable to escape. And when I realized I was free and no longer pinned to the floor, I saw the god again, black as he had been before, but this time he was robust, as if the blaze had only baked him and he retained his full strength. His face had definition, even beauty, features well formed beneath the cracked casing of blackened leather that was his skin. The yellow eyes had round them now the natural folds of flesh that made them portals of a soul. But he was still crippled, still suffering, almost unable to move. "Rise, Marius," he said. "You thirst, and I will give you to drink. Rise and come to me." And you know then the ecstasy I felt when his blood came into me, when it worked its way into every vessel, every limb. But the horrid pendulum had only begun to swing. Hours passed in the oak as he took the blood out of me and gave it back over and over again. I lay sobbing on the floor when I was drained. I could see my hands like bones in front of me. I was shriveled as he had been. And again he would give me the blood to drink, and I would rise in a frenzy of exquisite feeling, only to have him take it out of me again. With every exchange there came the lessons, that I was immortal, that only the sun and the fire could kill me, that I would sleep by day in the earth, that I should never know illness or natural death, that my soul should never migrate from my form into another, that I was the servant of the mother, and that the moon would give me strength, that I would thrive on the blood of the evildoers, and even of the innocent who were sacrificed to the mother, that I should remain in starvation between sacrifices, so that my body would become dry and empty, like the dead wheat in the fields at winter, only to be filled with the blood of the sacrifice, and to become full and beautiful like the new plants of the spring. In my suffering and ecstasy there would be the cycle of the seasons,
and the powers of my mind, to read the thoughts and intentions of others. These I should use to make the judgments for my worshippers, to guide them in their justice and their laws. Never should I drink any blood but the blood of the sacrifice. Never should I seek to take my powers for my own. These things I learned, these things I understood. But what was really taught to me during those hours was what we all learn at the moment of the drinking of the blood, that I was no longer a mortal man, that I had passed away from all I knew into something so powerful that these old teachings could barely harness or explain it, that my destiny, to use Mael's words, was beyond all the knowledge that anyone, mortal or immortal, could give. At last the god prepared me to go out of the tree. He drained so much blood from me now that I was scarcely about to stand. I was a wraith. I was weeping from thirst. I was seeing blood and smelling blood and would have rushed at him and caught him and drained him had I the strength. But the strength, of course, was his. "You are empty, as you will always be at the commencement of the festival," he said, "so that you may drink your fill of the sacrificial blood. But remember what I have told you. After you preside, you must find a way to escape. As for me, try to save me. Tell them that I must be kept with you. But in all likelihood, my time has come to an end." "Why? How do you mean?" I asked. "You will see. There need be only one God here, one good God," he said. "If I could only go with you to Egypt, I could drink the blood of the old ones and it might heal me. As it is, I will take hundreds of years to heal, and I shall not be allowed that time. But remember, go into Egypt, do all that I have said." He turned to me now and pushed me towards the stairs. The torch lay blazing in the corner, and as I rose towards the door above, I smelled the blood of the druids waiting, and I almost wept. "They will give you all the blood that you can take," he said behind me. "Place yourself in their hands." 8. You can well imagine how I looked when I stepped from the oak. The druids had waited for my knock upon the door, and in my silent voice I had said, "Open, it is the god." My human death was long finished. I was ravenous, and surely my face was no more than a living skull. No doubt my eyes were bulging from their sockets, and my teeth were bared. The white robe hung on me as on a skeleton, and no clearer evidence of my divinity could have been given to the druids who stood awestruck as I came out of the tree. But I saw not merely their faces, I saw into their hearts. I saw the relief in Mael, that the god within had not been too feeble to create me. I saw the confirmation in him of all that he believed. And I saw the other great vision that is ours to see, the great spiritual depth of each man buried deep within a crucible of heated flesh and blood. My thirst was pure agony, and summoning all my new strength, I said, "Take me to the altars. The feast of Samhain is to begin." The druids let out chilling screams. They howled in the forest. And far beyond the sacred grove there came a deafening roar from the multitudes who had waited for that cry. We walked swiftly in procession towards the clearing, and more of the white-robed priests came out to greet us, and I found myself pelted with fresh and fragrant flowers from all sides, blossoms I crushed under my feet as I was saluted with hymns. I need not tell you how the world looked to me with a new vision. How I saw each tint and surface beneath the thin veil of darkness, how these hymns and anthems assaulted my ears. Marius, the man, was disintegrated inside this new being. Trumpets blared from the clearing as I mounted the steps of the stone altar and looked out over the thousands gathered there, the sea of expectant faces, the giant wicker figures with their doomed victims still struggling and crying inside. A great silver cauldron of water stood before the altar, and as the priests sang, a chain of prisoners was led to this cauldron, their arms bound behind their backs. The voices were singing in concert around me as the priests placed the flowers in my hair, on my shoulders, at my feet. "Beautiful one, powerful one, god of the woods and the fields, drink now the sacrifices offered to you, and as your wasted limbs fill with life, so the earth will renew itself. So you will forgive us for the cutting of the corn, which is the harvest. So you will bless the seed we sow." And I saw before me those selected to be my victims. Three stout men, bound as the others were bound, but clean, and dressed also in white robes, with flowers on their shoulders and in their hair. Youths they were, handsome and innocent, and overcome with awe as they awaited the will of the god. The trumpets were deafening. The roaring was ceaseless. I said, "Let the sacrifices begin," and as the first youth was delivered up to me, as I prepared to drink for the very first time from that truly divine cup which is human life, as I held the warm flesh of the victim in my hands, their blood ready for my open mouth, I saw the fires lighted beneath the towering wicker giants. I saw the first two prisoners forced head down into the water of the silver cauldron. Death by fire, death by water, death by the piercing teeth of the hungry god. Through the age-old ecstasy the hymns continued. God of the waning and waxing moon, god of the woods and fields, you who are the very image of death in your hunger, grow strong with the blood of the victims, grow beautiful so that the great mother will take you to herself. How long did it last? I do not know. It was forever. The blaze of the wicker giants, the screaming of the victims, the long procession of those who must be drowned. I drank and drank, not merely from the three selected for me, but from a dozen others before they were returned to the cauldron, or forced into the blazing giants. The priests cut the heads from the dead with great bloody swords, stacking them in pyramids to either side of the altar, and the bodies were borne away. Everywhere I turned, I saw rapture on sweating faces. Everywhere I turned, I heard the anthems and cries. But at last the frenzy was dying out. The giants were fallen into a smouldering heap, upon which men poured more pitch, more kindling. And it was now time for the judgments, for men to stand before me, and present their cases for vengeance against others, and for me to look with my new eyes into their souls. I was reeling. I had drunk too much blood, but I felt such power in me I could have leapt up and over the clearing and deep into the forest. I could have spread invisible wings, or so it seemed. But I carried out my destiny, as Mael would have called it. I found this one just, that one in error, this one innocent, that one deserving of death. I don't know how long it went on, because my body no longer measured time in weariness. But finally it was finished, and I realized the moment of action had come. I had somehow to do what the old god had commanded me, which was to escape the imprisonment in the oak, and I also had precious little time in which to do it, no more than an hour before dawn. As for what lay ahead in Egypt, I had not made my decision yet, but I knew that if I let the druids enclose me in the sacred tree again, I would starve in there until the small offering at the next full moon, and all of my nights until that time would be thirst and torture, and what the old one had called the god's dreams, in which I'd learned the secrets of the tree and the grass that grew and the silent mother. But these secrets were not for me. The druids surrounded me now, and we proceeded to the sacred tree again, the hymns dying to a litany which commanded me to remain within the oak, to sanctify the forest, to be its guardian, and to speak kindly through the oak to those of the priesthood who would come from time to time to ask guidance of me. I stopped before we reached the tree. A huge pyre was blazing in the middle of the grove, casting ghastly light on the carved faces and the heaps of human skulls. The rest of the priesthood stood round it waiting. A current of terror shot through me with all the new power that such feelings have for us. I started talking hastily. In an authoritative voice I told them that I wished them all to leave the grove. that I should seal myself up in the oak at dawn with the old god. But I could see it wasn't working. They were staring at me coldly and glancing one to the other, their eyes shallow like bits of glass.
"Mael," I said, "do as I command you. Tell these priests to leave the grove."
Suddenly, without the slightest warning, half the assemblage of priests ran towards the tree. The other took hold of my arms. I shouted for Mael, who led the siege on the tree, to stop. I tried to get loose, but some 12 of the priests gripped my arms and my legs.
If I had only understood the extent of my strength, I might easily have freed myself. But I didn't know. I was still reeling from the feast, too horrified by what I knew would happen now. As I struggled, trying to free my arms, even kicking at those who held me, the old god, the naked and black thing, was borne out of the tree and heaved into the fire. Only for a split second did I see him, and all I beheld was resignation. He did not once lift his arms to fight. His eyes were closed, and he did not look at me, nor at anyone or anything. And I remembered in that moment what he had told me of his agony, and I started to cry. I was shaking violently as they burned him. But from the very midst of the flames I heard his voice, "Do as I commanded you, Marius. You are our hope." That meant, "Get out of here now." I made myself still and small in the grip of those who held me. I wept and wept, and acted like I was just the sad victim of all this magic, just the poor god who must mourn his father who had gone into the flames. And when I felt their hands relax, when I saw that, one and all, they were gazing into the pyre, I pivoted with all my strength, tearing loose from their grip, and I ran as fast as I could for the woods. In that initial sprint, I learned for the first time what my powers were. I cleared the hundreds of yards in an instant, my feet barely touching the ground. But the cry rang out immediately, "The god has flown!" And within seconds the multitude in the clearing was screaming it over and over as thousands of mortals plunged into the trees. "How on earth did this happen?" I thought suddenly, "that I'm a god, full of human blood, and running from thousands of Celtic barbarians through this damned woods." I didn't even stop to tear the white robe off me, but ripped it off while I was still running, and then I leapt up to the branches overhead and moved even faster through the tops of the oaks. Within minutes I was so far away from my pursuers that I couldn't hear them any more. But I kept running and running, leaping from branch to branch, until there was nothing to fear any more but the morning sun. And I learned then what Gabriel learned so early in your wanderings, that I could easily dig into the earth to save myself from the light. When I awoke, the heat of my thirst astonished me. I could not imagine how the old god had endured the ritual starvation. I could think only of human blood. But the druids had had the day in which to pursue me. I had to proceed with great care. And I starved all that night as I sped through the forest, not drinking until early morning, when I came upon a band of thieves in the woods, which provided me with the blood of an evildoer and a good suit of clothes. In those hours just before dawn, I took stock of things. I learned a great deal about my powers. I would learn more, and I would go down to Egypt, not for the sake of the gods or their worshippers, but to find out what this was all about. And so even then, you see, more than 1700 years ago, we were questing. We were rejecting the explanations given us. We were loving the magic and the power for its own sake. On the third night of my new life, I wandered into my old house in Massilia and found my library, my writing table, my books all there still, and my faithful slaves overjoyed to see me. What did these things mean to me? What did it mean that I had written this history, that I had lain in this bed? I knew I could not be Marius, the Roman, any longer. But I would take from him what I could. I sent my beloved slaves back home.
I wrote my father to say that a serious illness compelled me to live out my remaining days in the heat and dryness of Egypt. I packed off the rest of my history to those in Rome who would read it and publish it, and then I set out for Alexandria with gold in my pockets, with my old travel documents, and with two dull-witted slaves who never questioned that I travelled by night. And within a month of the great Samhain feast in Gaul, I was roaming the black, crooked nighttime streets of Alexandria, searching for the old gods with my silent voice. I was mad, but I knew the madness would pass. I had to find the old gods. And you know why I had to find them. It was not only the threat of the calamity again, the sun god seeking me out in the darkness of my daytime slumber, or visiting me with obliterating fire in the full darkness of the night. I had to find the old gods because I could not bear to be alone among men. The full horror of it was upon me, and though I killed only the murderer, the evildoer, my conscience was too finely tuned for self-deception. I could not bear the realization that I, Marius, who had known and enjoyed such love in his life, was the relentless bringer of death. 9. Alexandria was not an old city. It had existed for just a little over 300 years. But it was a great port, and the home of the largest libraries in the Roman world. Scholars from all over the empire came to study there, and I had been one of them in another lifetime. And now I found myself there again. Had not the god told me to come, I would have gone deeper into Egypt, to the bottom, to use Mayle's phrase, suspecting that the answers to all riddles lay in the older shrines. But a curious feeling came on me in Alexandria. I knew the gods were there. I knew they were guiding my feet when I sought the streets of the whorehouses and the thieves' dens, the places where men went to lose their souls. At night I lay on my bed in my little Roman house, and I called to the gods. I grappled with my madness. I puzzled just as you have puzzled over the power and strength and crippling emotions which I now possessed. And one night just before morning, when the light of only one lamp shone through the sheer veils of the bed where I lay, I turned my eyes towards the distant garden doorway, and saw a still black figure standing there. For one moment it seemed a dream, this figure, because it carried no scent, did not seem to breathe, did not make a sound. Then I knew it was one of the gods. But it was gone, and I was left sitting up and staring after it, trying to remember what I had seen. A black, naked thing, with a bald head and red, piercing eyes, a thing that seemed lost in its own stillness, strangely diffident, only marshalling its strength to move at the last moment before complete discovery. The next night in the back streets, I heard a voice telling me to come. But it was a less articulate voice than that which had come from the tree. It made known to me only that the door was near. And finally, there came the still and silent moment when I stood before the door. It was a god who opened it for me. It was a god who said, "Come." I was frightened as I descended the inevitable stairway, as I followed a steeply sloping tunnel. I lighted the candle I had brought with me, and I saw that I was entering an underground temple. A place older than the city of Alexandria, a sanctuary built perhaps under the ancient pharaohs, its walls covered with tiny coloured pictures depicting the life of old Egypt. And then there was the writing, the magnificent picture writing, with its tiny mummies and birds, and embracing arms without bodies and coiling snakes. I moved on, coming into a vast place of square pillars and a soaring ceiling. The same paintings decorated every inch of stone here. And then I saw in the corner of my eye what seemed at first a statue, a black figure standing near a pillar with one hand raised to rest against a stone. But I knew it was no statue. No Egyptian god made out of diorite ever stood in this attitude, nor wore a real linen skirt about its loins. I turned slowly, bracing myself against a full sight of it, and saw the same burnt flesh, the same streaming hair, though it was black, the same yellow eyes. The lips were shriveled around the teeth, and the gums and the breath came out of its throat full of pain. "How and whence did you come?" he asked in Greek. I saw myself as he saw me, luminous and strong, even my blue eyes something of an incidental mystery. And I saw my Roman garments, my linen tunic gathered in gold buckles on my shoulders, my red cloak. With my long yellow hair I must have looked like a wanderer from the North Woods, civilized only on the surface. And perhaps this was now true. But he was the one who concerned me, and I saw him more fully. The seamed flesh burnt to his ribs and molded to his collarbone and the jutting bones of his hips. He was not starved, this thing. He had recently drunk human blood. But his agony was like heat coming from him, as though the fire still cooked him from within, as though he were a self-contained hell. "How have you escaped the burning?" he asked. "What saved you? Answer!" "Nothing saved me," I said, speaking Greek as he did. I approached him holding the candle to the side when he shied from it. He had been thin in life, broad-shouldered like the old pharaohs, and his long black hair was cropped straight across the forehead in that old style. "I wasn't made when it happened," I said, "but afterwards, by the god of the sacred grove in Gaul." "Ah, then he was unharmed, this one who made you. No, burned as you are. But he had enough strength to do it. He gave and took the blood over and over again. He said, 'Go into Egypt and find why this has happened.' He said the gods of the wood had burst into flames, some in their sleep and some awake. He said this had happened all over the north." "Yes," he nodded, and he gave a dry rasping laugh that shook his entire form. "And only the ancient had the strength to survive, to inherit the agony which only immortality can sustain. And so we suffer. But you have been made. You have come. You will make more. But is it justice to make more? Would the father and the mother have allowed this to happen to us if the time had not come?" "But who are the father and the mother?" I asked. I knew he did not mean the earth when he said mother. "The first of us," he answered, "those from whom all of us descend." I tried to penetrate his thoughts, feel the truth of them, but he knew what I was doing, and his mind folded up like a flower at dusk. "Come with me," he said, and he commenced to walk with a shuffling step out of the large room and down a long corridor decorated as the chamber had been. I sensed we were in an even older place. Something built before the temple from which we'd just come. I do not know how I knew it. The chill you felt on the steps here on the island was not there. You don't feel such things in Egypt. You feel something else. You feel the presence of something living in the air itself. But there was more palpable evidence of antiquity as we walked on. The paintings on these walls were older, the colors fainter. And here and there was damage where the colored plaster had flaked and fallen away. The style had changed. The black hair of the little figures was longer and fuller, and it seemed the whole was more lovely, more full of light and intricate design. Somewhere far off, water dripped on stone. The sound gave a song-like echo through the passage. It seemed the walls had captured life in these delicate and tenderly painted figures. It seemed that the magic attempted again and again by the ancient religious artists had its tiny glowing kernel of power. I could hear whispers of life where there were no whispers. I could feel the great continuity of history, even if there was no one who was aware. The dark figure beside me paused as I looked at the walls. He made an airy gesture for me to follow him through a doorway, and we entered a long rectangular chamber covered entirely with the artful hieroglyphs. It was like being encased in a manuscript to be inside it. And I saw two older Egyptian sarcophagi placed head to head against the wall. These were boxes carved to conform to the shape of the mummies for which they were made, and fully modelled and painted to represent the dead, with faces of hammered gold, the eyes of inlaid lapis lazuli. I held the candle high, and with great effort my guide opened the lids of these cases and let them fall back so that I might see inside. I saw what at first appeared to be bodies, but when I drew closer, I realized that they were heaps of ash in manly form. Nothing of tissue remained to them except a white fang here, a chip of bone there. "No amount of blood can bring them back now," said my guide. "They are past all resurrection. The vessels of the blood are gone. Those who could rise have risen, and centuries will pass before we are healed, before we know the cessation of our pain." Before he closed the mummy cases, I saw that the lids inside were blackened by the fire that had immolated these two. I wasn't sorry to see them shut up again. He turned and moved towards the doorway again, and I followed with a candle, but he paused and glanced back at the painted coffins. "When the ashes are scattered," he said, "their souls are free." "Then why don't you scatter the ashes?" I said, trying not to sound so desperate, so undone. "Should I?" he asked of me, the crisped flesh around his eyes widening. "Do you think that I should?"
"You ask me," I said. He gave one of those dry laughs again that seemed to carry agony with it, and he led on down the passage to the lighted room. It was a library we entered, where a few scattered candles revealed the diamond-shaped wooden racks of parchment and papyrus scrolls. This delighted me naturally, because a library was something I could understand. It was the one human place in which I still felt some measure of old sanity. But I was startled to see another one of us, sitting to the side behind the writing table, his eyes on the floor. This one had no hair whatsoever. And though he was pitch black all over, his skin was full and well modelled and gleamed as if it had been oiled. The planes of his face were beautiful. The hand that rested in the lap of his white linen kilt was gracefully curled, all the muscles of his naked chest well defined. He turned and looked up at me, and something immediately passed between us, something more silent than silence as it can be with us. "This is the elder," said the weaker one who'd brought me here, "and you see for yourself how he withstood the fire. He will not speak. He has not spoken since it happened. Yet surely he knows where are the mother and the father, and why this was allowed to pass." The elder merely looked forward again. But there was a curious expression on his face, something sarcastic and faintly amused and a little contemptuous. "Even before this disaster," the other one said, "the elder did not often speak to us. The fire did not change him, make him more receptive. He sits in silence, more and more like the mother and the father. Now and then he reads. Now and then he walks in the world above. He drinks the blood. He listens to the singers. Now and then he will dance. He speaks to mortals in the streets of Alexandria, but he will not speak to us. He has nothing to say to us. But he knows why this happened to us." "Leave me with him," I said. I had the feeling that all beings have in such situations. I will make the man speak. I will draw something out of him, as no one else has been able to do. But it wasn't mere vanity that impelled me. This was the one who had come to me in the bedroom of my house. I was sure of it. This was the one who had stood watching me in my door. And I had sensed something in his glance. Call it intelligence, call it interest, call it recognition of some common knowledge. There was something there. And I knew that I carried with me the possibilities of a different world, unknown to the god of the grove and even to this feeble and wounded one beside me who looked at the elder in despair. The feeble one withdrew as I had asked. I went to the writing table and looked at the elder. "What should I do?" I asked in Greek. He looked up at me abruptly,
and I could see this thing I call intelligence in his face.
"Is there any point," I asked, "to questioning you further?"
I had chosen my tone carefully. There was nothing formal in it, nothing reverential. It was as familiar as it could be.
"And just what is it you seek?" he asked in Latin suddenly,
coldly, his mouth turning down at the ends, his attitude one of abruptness and challenge. It relieved me to switch to Latin.
"You heard what I told the other," I said in the same informal manner, "how I was made by the god of the grove in the country of the Celtoi, and how I was told to discover why the gods had died in flames."
"You don't come on behalf of the gods of the grove," he said, sardonic as before. He had not lifted his head, merely looked up, which made his eyes seem all the more challenging and contemptuous.
"I do and I don't," I said. "If we can perish in this way, I would like to know why. What happened once can happen a second time. And I would like to know if we are really gods, and if we are, then what are our obligations to man? Are the mother and the father true beings, or are they legend? How did all this start? I would like to know that, of course."
"By accident," he said.
"By accident?" I leaned forward. I thought I had heard wrong.
"By accident it started," he said coolly, forbiddingly, with a clear implication that the question was absurd. 4,000 years ago, by accident, and it has been enclosed in magic and religion ever since."
"You are telling me the truth, aren't you?"
"Why shouldn't I? Why should I protect you from the truth? Why should I bother to lie to you? I don't even know who you are. I don't care."
"Then will you explain to me what you mean, that it happened by accident?" I pressed.
"I don't know. I may not. I have spoken more in these last few moments than I have in years. The story of the accident may be no more truth than the myths that delight the others. The others have always chosen the myths. It's what you really want, is it not?" His voice rose, and he rose slightly out of his chair, as if his angry voice were impelling him to his feet. "A story of our creation, analogous to the Genesis of the Hebrews, the tales in Homer, the babblings of your Roman poets Ovid and Virgil, a great gleaming morass of symbols out of which life itself is supposed to have sprung." He was on his feet and all but shouting, his black forehead knotted with veins, his hand a fist on the desk. "It is that kind of tale that fills the documents in these rooms, that emerges in fragments from the anthems and the incantations. Want to hear it? It's as true as anything else."
"Tell me what you will," I said. I was trying to keep calm. The volume of his voice was hurting my ears. And I heard things stirring in the rooms near us. Other creatures, like that dried-up wisp of a thing that had brought me in here, were prowling about.
"And you might begin," I said acidly, "by confessing why you came to me in my rooms here in Alexandria. It was you who led me here. Why did you do that? To rail at me? To curse me for asking you how it started?"
"Quiet yourself.
I might say the same to you."
He looked me up and down calmly, and then he smiled. He opened both his hands as if in greeting or offering, and then he shrugged.
"I want you to tell me about the accident," I said.
"I would beg you to tell me if I thought it would do any good. What can I do for you to make you tell?" His face underwent several remarkable transformations. I could feel his thoughts, but not hear them. Feel a high-pitched humor. And when he spoke again, his voice was thickened, as if he were fighting back sorrow, as if it were strangling him.
"Hearken to our old story," he said. "The good god Osiris, the first pharaoh of Egypt, in the eons before the invention of writing, was murdered by evil men. And when his wife Isis gathered together the parts of his body, he became immortal, and thereafter ruled in the realm of the dead. This is the realm of the moon and the night in which he reigned, and to him were brought the blood sacrifices for the great goddess which he drank. But the priests tried to steal from him the secret of his immortality, and so his worship became secret, and his temples were known only to those of his cult who protected him from the sun god, who might at any time seek to destroy Osiris with the sun's burning rays. But you can see the truth in the legend. The early king discovered something, or rather, he was the victim of an ugly occurrence, and he became unnatural with a power that could be used for incalculable evil by those around him, and so he made a worship of it, seeking to contain it in obligation and ceremony, seeking to limit the powerful blood to those who would use it for white magic and nothing else. And so here we are. And the mother and father are Isis and Osiris? Yes and no. They are the first two. Isis and Osiris are the names that were used in the myths that they told, or the old worship onto which they grafted themselves. What was the accident, then? How was this thing discovered?
He looked at me for a long period of silence, and then he sat down again, turning to the side and staring off as he'd been before.
"But why should I tell you?" he asked. Yet this time he put the question with new feeling, as though he meant it sincerely, but had to answer it for himself. "Why should I do anything? If the mother and the father will not rise from the sands to save themselves as the sun comes over the horizon, why should I move, or speak, or go on?" Again he looked up at me.
"This is what happened. The mother and the father went out into the sun.
We're left in the sun, my dear Marius," he said, astonishing me with the knowledge of my name. "Left in the sun. The mother and the father do not move of their own volition, save now and then to whisper to each other, to knock those of us down who would come to them for their healing blood. They could restore all of us who were burned if they would let us drink the healing blood. 4,000 years the father and mother have existed, and our blood grows stronger with every season, every victim. It grows stronger even with starvation, for when the starvation is ended, new strength is enjoyed. But the father and the mother do not care for their children, and now it seems they do not care for themselves. Maybe after 4,000 nights they merely wished to see the sun. Since the coming of the Greek into Egypt, since the perversion of the old art, they have not spoken to us. They have not let us see the blink of their eye. And what is Egypt now but the granary of Rome? When the mother and the father strike out to drive us away from the veins in their necks, they are as iron and can crush our bones. And if they do not care any more, then why should I?" I studied him for a long moment. "And you are saying," I asked, "that this is what caused the others to burn up? That the mother and father were left out in the sun?" He nodded. "Our blood comes from them," he said. "It is their blood. Their line is direct. And what befalls them befalls us. If they are burnt, we are burnt."
"We are connected to them," I whispered in amazement.
"Exactly, my dear Marius," he said, watching me, seeming to enjoy my fear. "That is why they have been kept for 1,000 years, the mother and the father. That is why victims are brought to them in sacrifice. That is why they are worshipped. What happens to them happens to us."
"Who did it? Who put them in the sun?" He laughed without making a sound.
"The one who kept them," he said. "The one who couldn't endure it any longer. The one who had had this solemn charge for too long. The one who could persuade no one else to accept the burden, and finally, weeping and shivering, took them out into the desert sands and left them like two statues there."
"And my fate is linked to this," I murmured.
"Yes. But do you see, I do not think he believed it any longer, the one who kept them. It was just an old tale. After all, they were worshipped, as I told you, worshipped by us as we are worshipped by mortals, and no one dared to harm them. No one held a torch to them to see if it made the rest of us feel pain. No, he did not believe it. He left them in the desert, and that night when he opened his eyes in his coffin and found himself a burnt and unrecognizable horror, he screamed and screamed."
"You got them back underground?"
"Yes."
"And they are blackened as you are?"
"No," he shook his head. "Darkened to a golden bronze, like the meat turning on the spit. No more than that. And beautiful as before, as if beauty has become part of their heritage, beauty part and parcel of what they are destined to be. They stare forward, as they always have, but they no longer incline their heads to each other. They no longer hum with the rhythm of their secret exchanges. They no longer let us drink their blood. And the victims brought to them they will not take, save now and then and only in solitude. No one knows when they will drink, when they will not. I shook my head. I moved back and forth, my head bowed, the candle fluttering in my hand, not knowing what to